everything we see, in every creature, in every star, in your reflection, they live in you.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 27th, 2010. My name is James Marino, and in the conversation this afternoon, we're going to talk with Peter Felicia and Matthew Murray. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com and also writes for the Newark Star-Ledger. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic at talkonbroadway.com and also writes for Broadway Stars. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, James. How's it going?
Very good. So one of the things that we'd like to talk about today is that there are changes abound in Lion King, and that the show is about 9 minutes shorter, and Variety and a few other media outlets have talked about this extensively, and we thought we'd weigh in and talk about this a little bit. Peter, what do you think about changes of a show that has been ongoing for a number of years now?
Well, what's fascinating to me is that this announcement comes right around the 58th anniversary of Wish You Were Here opening on Broadway to lousy reviews, mostly lousy. And this was a musical that didn't go out of town, and because it had a swimming pool. So it opened to bad reviews, and everybody figured, all right, it's going to close. I mean, it's just another lousy Broadway musical. But they decided to go to work and fix it. So they just didn't leave it as it was. They went back after the show opened, and this is something that is seldom, if ever, done. So and they changed things. They dropped songs, they added songs, and they made it into a show that ran a year and a half. So it's certainly not unprecedented. And a more famous example, of course, is Hello, Dolly in 1964, when Come Be My Butterfly was the song in the second act that David Burns, when he was in the restaurant, the Harmonia Gardens, there was a lot of chaos going on there with a lot of girls dressed in butterfly outfits. In fact, if you get the original cast album, you'll see a picture of it on the back because the album was printed in advance, and they had the black and white photo of this on the back cover. And it was a little embarrassing as time went on because the song wasn't remotely on the album. So this is not unprecedented, and I think it's kind of a good thing when people look at a show a second time, a third time, a 12th time, and say, you know, maybe we can do this, maybe we can do that. It shows that they're not interested in just sitting pat and figure, we'll leave well enough alone. Certainly, there's been no problem so far. But if somebody wants to tweak something, I think it's a really good idea, certainly from the vantage point, too, that the shows are living, breathing things. And maybe it keeps people a little more on their toes when changes have to be put in so that things don't get stultifying. So I'm all for it. And by the way, I don't much like The Lion King, so the idea of it being 9 minutes shorter would certainly be of interest to me if I had to go see it again.
All righty. Matthew, what do you have to say about this?
The only thing I have to say is that I agree at least 100% with Peter, but I would add that, well, I think it's really great that the Disney company is looking at Lion King and saying, what sort of changes can we make to it? I really wish that, you know, a lot of these changes had been made at the beginning, along with ones that would make a better book and a more satisfying dramatic experience overall. The main thing that is being reported about the changes to the show is that they cut the song, The Morning Report, which is like the shortest song in the show. It's a minute and a half, 2 minutes, something like that, and is part of a total of 9 minutes out of the show. That's great, but the show is still, you know, about 2.5 hours long regardless, and I haven't seen The Lion King in, 11 years, and my recollection of what it was like back then is that it was a lot more than 9 minutes of excess that could have been trimmed. In fact, you put a zero on the end of that and you'd probably still be on the low side, in my opinion. So I do think it's great that they are willing to revisit it and rethink it for all the reasons Peter said, but I don't think it is necessarily going to improve The Lion King a great deal. I think that it has certain endemic flaws as a piece of writing that can't be so easily fixed. And I would love it if Disney would consider going back and revisiting that aspect of it. But since that's not ever going to happen, I think we need to be glad that they at least care about it enough to make it the best it can possibly be now. And the only other aspect of it I don't think we really touched on is that this came about as a result of the Las Vegas production when it was going to play there. And they knew that they didn't want to, according to the Variety story, they knew that they didn't want to cut it down to the 90-minute quote-unquote tab version that is true of a lot of the musicals that play there, but they did just sort of want to revisit it. And it's really kind of interesting from that standpoint about how often it happens that changes that go into productions elsewhere eventually come into New York. I know that that when Avenue Q played in Las Vegas, some changes that were put into the Las Vegas version there also ended up in New York. I seem to recall that one of them was some new lyrics or something to There's a Life Outside Your Apartment, and Purpose, the song that Princeton sings in the first act with the boxes, got some new music or something like that. And of course, you know, there are also the changes were made to Les Mis and stuff like that that have then sort of reverberated throughout the shows all around the world. So it's nice when that happens and that the creative teams are willing to try to keep the shows fresh. I certainly wish it would happen more often with other long-running shows, but anytime that creators want to do that, it's fine with me.
So you did mention Les Mis. I was thinking of other shows that have undergone these things. Scarlet Pimpernel but Scarlet Pimpernel almost was like a close and then an open and a close and then an open. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we went through three versions on Broadway in one mm-hmm. stretch that seemed like one long run, but it was a long run. It was in a whole other way. Yeah. And lots of money. Mm-hmm. So, will they invite the reviewers back?
I doubt it.
Will this be considered a revival for Tony purposes?
I doubt that too.
Yeah, there's no chance of that. But they don't need to invite the reviewers back.
Right.
The show isn't changing that much.
And
isn't having any box office issues. So.
That's my point, is that, you know, why? What is the impetus for Disney to touch a show? I mean, Peter touched upon shows that had a poor opening.
We're in trouble,
and we went back. Lion King certainly is not in trouble, and is a wild financial success by some means.
Then why don't we give Disney the benefit of the doubt and say that they're interested in the best possible product that they can give people? Perhaps it's an altruistic reason for all we know. They're entitled to certainly that assumption. It may not be grounded in reality at all, but nevertheless, it'd be nice if that were the reason. And while Wish You Were Here is an example of a show that did get lousy reviews, that wasn't the case with Dolly. With Dolly, Walter Kerr said he didn't much like Come Be My Butterfly, and that was in the middle of a rave review. A very famous quotation from that review is, "Don't bother holding on to your hats. You'll only be throwing them in the air anyway," which is really quite a wonderful quotation. So Gower Champion just wanted to make something good better. And perhaps he didn't feel that it had to be this, that Come Be My Butterfly was a good enough solution. So as a result, once all he needed was somebody else to bring it up, and that was enough to make him take action. So it might very well be the whim of Tom Schumacher, who runs that division for Disney, and he went to see the show again and said, "I just can't stand this section," and maybe ordered it be changed. It could be that simple. But nevertheless, I'm willing to give the benefit of the doubt that it was done for artistic reasons.
I am too. I actually completely believe that. There's no doubt in my mind about that. That's what really happened. But again, I would love it if they took a really good, clear-eyed look at the real skeleton of the show and said, "Well, this really isn't acceptable. We can make the entire show better and do that." And I know that isn't going to happen. But if they're really so concerned about the quality of the show as a piece of writing, there's so much more that they could do with The Lion King were they so inclined.
Well, while I'm not going to go back and see it again, what I would love to see that 9 minutes include are all the jokes about farting. There are so many jokes that deal with flatulence, and I know that if Walt Disney were alive, he would never have approved that. There's also a joke that depends on the word fuck. I'm not saying the word fuck is used. Of course it isn't. But nevertheless, there's a joke about you bucked up royally. And there's no question that that's what the underbelly of the joke is, that the joke depends on your knowledge of the expression, you fucked up royally. And many times I've thought about little kids in that audience hearing hearty grown-up laughter at you bucked up royally and turning to their parents and saying, what's the joke? And wondering how the parents handle that when that happens. Of course, some parents would simply say, oh, the joke is that the word fuck is and buck. You know, I mean, some parents may be that progressive to tell their kids that. But I'm sure there are parents who come to Lion King who aren't happy that the word fuck has been employed in a certain way. So I hope that if that's what's been dropped in the 9 minutes, I'd be thrilled.
All right, so enough with the Lion King. We we have another show here in New York, Hair, which is closing today. Which I wouldn't have imagined that it was gonna. It seemed that it took a very quick nosedive this spring, and I thought it was going fine. Am I out of the loop there, or did you guys feel the same way?
I was surprised that they didn't run the summer. I did expect Hair to close in September. Chicago aside, revivals really never do as well as we think they're going to do. It's fascinating how you can get rave reviews, as the Guys and Dolls revival did almost 20 years ago now. Those reviews were over the moon, and yet the show ran 1,000 performances. There does seem to be a limited market for revivals, especially with tickets so high. Because tickets are so expensive, when people feel they've seen a show and they check it off their list and that's the end of it. And I think that's why revivals, even with wonderful reviews and Tony Awards and what have you, and this definitely won the Tony for Best Revival, and there's only so much of a shelf life that any of them can have. I'm sorry that Hair's leaving, because I like Hair, always have, since the first moment I heard the album, the original off-Broadway cast album in late 67. I've been a big fan of Hair. So, and I thought this was a good production. I never thought it was going to run now and forever. I did think it would last at least until the end of the summer, and I'm sorry it's not going to be here. And I think that may have been a mistake, because I would think the tourists in the summer, there would have been enough of them who would have said, hey, let's go see Hair to keep it alive. So this may be a little premature, and yet we do see a lot of shows now, you know, saying we've got our money, let's not risk losing it. That's certainly true of Red, where Red won a Tony and there was a lot of interest in the show. I know three people, what's three people, I'll grant you, but I know three people who saw Red after the Tony Awards that hadn't particularly had interest in it before, people who were coming in from out of town. And to me, they may very well have been a microcosm for a lot of other people who say, oh, this is the one that won the Tony, this is the one I'll see. So, but again, the producers there decided, whoops, we made our money. Let's not risk anything by recasting, which costs money. And we might wind up in the red with Red. So they, you know, took their marbles and went home. And I understand that point of view, too. But I think Hair might have done well enough this summer to justify its lasting till at least September. But the producers decided otherwise.
Matthew, what do you think?
I generally trust producers when it comes to money. I think that they probably looked very seriously at the show and how it did last summer and what the advance ticket sales were like, and decided that for whatever reason, like Peter said, they didn't want to risk losing the money that they'd already made back. So I don't question that. I also agree with Peter in that this is a pretty good production of Hair. I was not around for the original, but I like the show, and I like the original cast recordings and all that. But my problem with Hair since the beginning has been, like Peter said, it has a short shelf life. It's about a very different world and a very different culture that has, I think, only a very, very limited resonance with the way that people live today and the way kids especially live today. So I'm not really surprised that it didn't last longer than it did. I think that it's got a very high quality of composition from Galt McDermott and Jerome Ragney and James Rado. It's unusually well written for even a rock musical, In part, it doesn't seem really like a rock musical. I mean, it seems more like a musical that just happens to use, you know, rock elements to it. But really, when you get right down to it, it's about a very specific period of time, 43 years ago now. And because it's so wrapped in the politics of its era, I don't think it easily speaks to people today. And once the initial excitement of the fact that it was around and the fact that it won the Tony Award and then the fact that there was a new cast, once all that wore off, I think that it was really just a matter of time until that happened. And, you know, it's interesting because in his book, The Season, William Goldman said that even by the time Hair opened on Broadway, it was dated. And at that point, it ran another 4 years or whatever. And so people were still able to put up with it. It was still current enough that it could be seen as part of the culture of the time. But it's so different from anything that we have today that I don't think it was ever going to last very long. When I wrote my review of Hair last year, I said what we really need is not a revival of Hair, but a new Hair, something that connects with the youth of today and the politics of today in a way that this show did once upon a time. And I still believe that. And I think that had that show opened on March 31st, 2009, perhaps it would still be running and there wouldn't be any question of it closing. But because I think that everyone who goes to the theater on some level wants something that really speaks to them. And Hair speaks to the, you know, to quote Ken Davenport from a couple of weeks ago on our Tony podcast, it speaks to the prime theater goer, who's the 50 to 60 year old woman who back then was Hair's current audience. And they're the ones buying the tickets today. And so I think that it was never fated to run much longer than it did, but it was a good production. And something else that I think I might have said last year when we talked about it is it had a fantastic transfer from the park. It started off in Central Park a few years ago as part of the public Shakespeare in the Park summer series, and had a totally different concept in the park. In the park, it was set in the park, and on Broadway, it was set in a Broadway theater. And it would have been so easy for them to just put up AstroTurf on the stage and say, well, it's set taking place in the park, so they didn't have to go to all the trouble of building a new set or anything like that. And they didn't do that. And to me, it really says a lot for director Diane Paulus that she was willing to give the show what it needed to be correct for its setting. So I have no issues with the show artistically. I think that they should be commended for the work they did, and that it is nice that it ran as long as it did, but I don't think anyone should cry over it's not having run longer.
Did either one of you go back to see it with the new cast?
No,
I didn't. I wasn't invited. I don't know if they invited anybody, actually.
I didn't see the new cast, but I reading on the message boards of Talkin' Broadway and various emails and discussions elsewhere that the new cast didn't have the cohesion that the original cast had, which very often happens.
Sure.
And I wonder, I have to go back and look at grosses and ticket sales as the cast was changing and see if that could have been it, that, you know, stunt, you know, certainly it's not going to run as long as Les Mis, but maybe it left us prematurely, as well as having such a bad reception in London.
It's really interesting that you said that about the original cast, because if the original cast really had so much cohesion, you would have think that when they pretty much all went over to London, that the show might have really captured people's imagination a little bit better there. I mean, maybe not. Again, it's very political. It's very American. But yeah. I don't think the cast was the problem here.
And another thing I was thinking, and you two might reach through the microphone to kill me. Could there have been a star casting that could have saved this show?
I don't think that's a bad idea.
I mean, there's a lot of rock and rollers out there.
There was sort of a star casting, wasn't there? I mean, let me look. There was someone in Kyle Riabko, I think, went into it, and he's a name. I mean, there are people who know, and Ace Young, for that matter, is in it. So Diana DeGarmo, I'm looking at the photo on Playbill.com right now. These are all people with names that are known outside the theater community. In at least two cases from American Idol, and I have to be honest, I can't remember what Kyle Riabko's other credit is, but I know that he is known for things outside of Broadway and musical theater.
Well, so they're stars trying. And they're stars, but I mean,
well, I agree with you, but they were trying to put names in there that they thought would attract people and that might be appropriate. I can't think of a big
and yet the signs I saw on the sides of buses simply said hair.
Hair.
So maybe they needed to promote these people.
Marketing effort.
More.
Of it, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that would have helped.
So okay. Well, you know, Peter had mentioned something a few minutes ago. We talked about. Well, it's the revival of it, and it's never expected to, you know, run as long as the original. And it prompted a thought that I had was, you know, is there any chance that we could just get rid of the revival category at the Tonys and let everything fend for itself on its own?
I would love that. Do it tomorrow, please. I beg of you.
Peter, what's the history of that?
Well, ironically enough, when I was Drama Desk president, we did that one year, the year that Showboat was up against what was the same season as Sunset Boulevard and Smokey Joe's Cafe. You may know that those were the only two musicals in contention during that Tony season, and there was certainly no doubt in anybody's mind that Sunset Boulevard was going to wind up being the winner. Nobody knew at that time, however, that Smokey Joe's Cafe would run substantially longer than Sunset Boulevard, but nevertheless, in terms of worth, it was deemed artistically that Sunset Boulevard was the better of the two shows, and it won. I remember vividly at our nomination meetings, I said, you know, I just hate the idea that we have to give an award to either Sunset Boulevard or Smokey Joe's Cafe is the best musical, since none of the seven of us on this committee believe that these are particularly good musicals. So as a result, why don't we just lump it in? And this year we're going to call it Best Musical Production, and that's going to be the end of it. And I'm telling you, everybody jumped on the idea. Everybody thought it was a great idea, and nobody worried about it for a tenth of a second. And suddenly that season, and I think it's the only one in the history of the Drama Desk, it was Best Musical Production, and Showboat one. So, you know, Hollywood does remakes, doesn't it? And when Hollywood does a remake, if it's not, it can be nominated for an Oscar as Best Picture. There's no Best Revival category in the movies. So why must we have it here? So it would be very interesting to see if revivals would routinely beat new musicals. It might be very embarrassing in a way. And I think that maybe the powers that be might very well fear that we're going to see old shows beat new shows routinely. But that's the one precedent that I can certainly mention.
Speaking of revivals, Peter pointed out something right before the podcast started, that Night Music is, quote unquote, trending now on the front page of Yahoo. It was interesting to note that I guess it's not really Night Music, but Bernadette Peters is trending on the front page.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me. I have to admit that I always look at this trending now. There are 10 categories that are shown every day, and you find out what people are looking up more than anything else. And when I saw Bernadette Peters as number one, I thought, oh my God, she died. I mean, that's what I had to think of. And when I clicked on, it was all about her succeeding Catherine Zeta-Jones in Night Music. And that really surprised me that people were that interested in this. I'm delighted they are. I hope it means that people are chomping at the bit to go and see her, but nevertheless, I was very surprised to see her in first place, while far more famous contemporary names were there below her. So that's a nice sign that people are that interested.
Yeah, it's great, you know, because Bernadette's going in to replace, and that's giving second life to Night Music. Also, Race is getting some replacements. Matthew just mentioned to me before the podcast started, Dennis Haysbert. Who else is going into Race?
Eddie Izzard is also
going into it. And originally, the role of the woman in the show, Susan, was played by Kerry Washington, and her understudy has actually gone on and assumed the role now, which I think is always nice when that happens, because David Mamet, the director, obviously saw something in her that made him think that, oh, yeah, I'm going to take a chance on her. She doesn't have a name, but she deserves to be seen, and I think it's always great when something like that happens and the understudy gets a chance to make good and make the lead paycheck for a while. So, yeah, we'll be talking about that next week because it reopens to critics this Thursday.
Excellent. So you guys going to go back and see Night Music?
Sure.
And
if I'm invited, I'll go.
And
I'm sure they'll invite us.
So in the next couple of weeks,
they'll certainly have seats because obviously they had no advance sale for this extension because nobody knew that it was happening. So I think with plenty of seats to fill, they'll figure, you know, this is another way of papering the house.
There's no truth to the rumor that Night Music has changed their name to Fences 2.
That's right.
So, okay. All right, so in the next couple of weeks, we'll talk about Night Music and Race. We'll revisit them once again. But on to new stuff, or sort of new stuff.
Sort of
new. Peter got to see Ideal over at 59 East 59, which was the third in the trifecta of shows that you've seen at 59 East 59 in the last couple of weeks. So why don't you tell us about Ayn Rand's newest work?
Yes, this is by Ayn Rand, who was one of the most controversial / beloved authors of the 20th century. She's most famous for her epic novels, Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, but she was a person who believed in individuality. She was born in Soviet Russia and Soviet Union and hated the system there, came to America, loved the idea that man had the ability here to be what the best that he could be, that he was only responsible to himself. This play deals with Hollywood, and that may sound a little strange, but Ayn Rand had a big history with Hollywood. She certainly was a type of protege even of Cecil B. DeMille, who really helped her along the way, and she wrote for the movies for a while with intermittent success. But this is a play about a big star named Kay Gonda. And in fact, what's ironic, in the text, she's always referred to as Kay Gonda. Both names are always used. And she's on the loose at the moment and on the lam because it seems that she killed a man. And what she does is she goes to 6 different houses of fans who have written her letters saying, "Will you take me in for the night?" And it's really a very interesting look at what people will or will not do after writing fan letters saying, oh, you are all that matters to me. You are the sun and the moon and the stars. And to meet you would be, well, here I am. Now, will you take me in for the night? Will you? I'm telling you up front, I have murdered somebody. Now, what will you do to help me? And it's very interesting to see the different reactions of various people, including, by the way, a minister whose church is not doing terribly well. And there's a very interesting scene with an Amy Semple McPherson type person who is lauding it all over the mass, the minister that he's playing everything by the religious book and he's dying on the vine while she is taking a more showbiz approach to church, and she's succeeding. So there's a lot of commentary on what life was like in Hollywood in the 30s. And while the play gets a tiny bit repetitious, and while the ending may be a little less than satisfying, it is a fascinating look. I will say that the production is not top-notch. The people who are doing it, it's a young organization, they do seem a little too young for it and a little too unseasoned. So it's not the quintessential production of this play, which never was produced on Broadway and did get a few productions here and there. So this is its New York premiere, and it is worth seeing for those people who are interested in everything that Ayn Rand does. There's a convention every year where people buy all sorts of memorabilia. It's like Trekkies. So I guess there are Randys. I'm not saying Randy activity goes on after the convention, but nevertheless, there are people who really, really care about Ayn Rand, and certainly those people are going to pack this little room. I don't think there are more than 60 seats available. 3 rows, I think, is as far deep as the seats get. But nevertheless, it is a rare chance to catch a work by a very illustrious writer. So if one is into collecting such experiences, and the word collecting has to be used very judiciously here because Ayn Rand hated the term collective. So this is the time to go because I don't think we're going to see it again. By the way, it has so many different characters, and of course the cast doubles like crazy. But it is interesting to think that when it was written back in the 30s that Ayn Rand did think that there'd be no problem putting on a play of this scope with so many different characters. I'm sure she didn't think of doubling in those days when they really didn't think very much of that. So as a result, that's another reason why it's not going to get produced terribly often. So just beware that the cast isn't quite up to it.
Peter, have you ever seen a production of this play anywhere else? Or, I mean, have you been aware that there have been other productions of this play in your theater-going history?
No, I have never been offered the chance to see this play before that I know of. So that's why I jumped at the opportunity, because she's such a fascinating writer and such an interesting woman. And she used to be on TV talk shows routinely talking about how she didn't believe in God and how God was really something that was dangerous to mankind because it was too easy a crutch to fall back on. And so she was a fascinating maverick, no question about it. And she does interest me, and that's why I jumped at the opportunity.
You know, Peter, you mentioned that she was a protege of Cecil B. DeMille, and he was never one for doing things small. So maybe,
that's right. Yeah, yeah, good point.
You know,
yeah,
large epic movies, long, thousands upon thousands of people in a cast. So,
yeah, good point. Right. Yeah.
All right, so 59 East 59 is a place that, you know, you can camp out for a few days and see a bunch of interesting shows.
Sure, sure. So,
you also made it up to White Plains, where you saw a production of Edges. Why don't you tell us a little about the show and the organization?
Yeah, the White Plains Performing Arts Center does have this conservatory where it deals with young people. And so they're doing this contemporary musical by two writers I never heard of, Benj. The first four letters of Benjamin Pasek and Justin Paul, who, like Adler and Ross, do both music and lyrics together. So it's not one gets one credit and one gets the other. They both get credit for music and lyrics. And Jeremy Quinn, who runs a terrific program up there, directed this review. It actually started out simply as a song cycle. And then they thought, well, maybe there's a musical in this. So I was very impressed by the songs. The lyrics were extraordinarily intelligent, and especially the ideas for the songs were really kind of interesting. A woman drops all her friends because her boyfriend doesn't like them, and you know, he must come first. Two gay men have been getting along superbly, but they can't quite commit. So they sing a song called I Hmm You, you know, and you can infer whether that hmm means like or love. A woman decides that the perfect man for her is a gay man she knows, because she gets almost everything she wants while she goes shopping with him or going to the theater with him or what have you. There's only one thing that he's lacking, of course, and she would like to have that, but her feeling is that she doesn't have to worry about that. She can go out looking for that on her spare time when she's not with this guy, but at least he fulfills all her other needs, and she's looking at the glass as 9/10 full rather than empty. So the interesting ideas, you know, two sisters growing apart and wishing they were close as they once were, but they have to face the reality that they're growing up and they're going in different directions, and there's really nothing that they can much do about it, even though they wish that they could be young and foolish again and just accept each other for what they were. But as you get older, you know, you do find out who you are, and when you find out that you're not in simpatico with your sister, well, what can you do? So these are interesting ideas. Eight people in the cast, all very good, but I have a feeling that we're going to hear from three of them in the future. I will mention their names now because we'll see if years to come that they amounted to anything. I expect that they will. Travis McClung, Emily Tarpe, and Allison Zarrett. We'll see what happens, but they really stood out in the eight-member cast, and I enjoyed them immeasurably, and I hope this show has a future. This is the type of show that strikes me would be right at home at New World Stages, so I hope we get to see it there really soon.
Peter, maybe you said this and I missed it. Is this a review or is it a book musical?
No, it's more review with a through line.
Okay.
You know, the gay lovers, for example, you know, you follow their journey a bit. You know, I mean, it's certainly there's not a word of dialogue. It's simply one song after the other. One can infer that there's a through line. It's also easy to miss, too. But the important thing is that the songs are very good and they're very well done, and the direction is fine. So as a result, I hope there's a future for Edges.
And how long is it playing up in White Plains?
Oh, it's gone already.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was because this is a conservatory thing. It's by the time this airs, it will have disappeared. So it was only going to be done this weekend, and I was lucky enough to get up there and see it.
All right. So there was a charity benefit, extra benefit for last session?
Yeah, there was. The last session, a musical that played several years ago on 47th Street for a good long time, they decided to do a benefit for St. Clement's Food Pantry and Free Vet Clinic, which was really a nice charity idea because that food pantry, I've passed by 46th Street and I've seen people line up there that they need the food. And Free Vet Clinic, isn't that nice? I mean, that's really great that people who have sick animals and don't have the money to tend to them can at least get some help over there on 46th Street. So that's really good. So Steve Schlacklin and librettist, he's a songwriter, and Jim Brochu, who's more famous now for being Zero Mostel and Zero Hour, wrote this musical some years ago, and they put it on for one night, and they played roles in it. And it was very successful. It's a very moving story about a man who has AIDS, and he doesn't see his life getting any better. And the medications at that time were not the as effective as they are now. So as a result, he has decided to commit suicide, but he's going to record his songs one last time. One of the problems is that one of the people who comes in to record is a Bible Belt kid who's been brought up to be homophobic. And when he finds out that he's actually recording songs about gay life, he takes the opportunity to pontificate on that. And the journey that he's going to have to take during these songs is a most interesting one indeed. It's a good show, and it was very well done. And what was really nice, the 11 o'clock number, the singer and the song, got the best type of applause, my favorite type of applause. And that's where people applaud strongly, okay? And then the applause starts to die, as every applause must do. But the people still want to show that they like the song, and maybe they didn't give it enough applause. So now they applaud harder than they even did at the beginning. So you have this wonderful wave of, you know, like applause. If we were an applause meter, the applause went up to 8 and then down to 3, but then up to 10 before it faded for the last time. And that doesn't happen very often. And I'm really always thrilled when it happens, and that's exactly what happened here. So it was well deserved. So it was nice to see the last session again, which is a show that I think really should be done more often in communities that need to see it.
You know, Matthew and I have a different relationship to the last session. Years and years ago, when Matthew and I were part of a mailing list called RATM, RATM, which is Rec Arts Theater Musicals. Steve was, who wrote the show, was on this list and sort of, you know, kept on posting that he was writing this show and gave us little bits and pieces of it. It was very interesting to see it. And also Steve had a blog called Life in the Bonus Round.
Right. He still does, in fact.
Yeah. And where he, you know, when RATM was around, nobody really had blogs. No, there wasn't much of an internet at that point. Life in the Bonus Round came after it. But it was, we got to know Steve through these posts, and it was one of the first, what I consider kind of internet-based musicals, in the fact that he was kind of doing a test market with these folks who love musical theater on this mailing list. So that's pretty much it. We also heard some very sad news this morning. Peter mentioned to us that there was a posting on All That Chat that John Willis had passed away. Many of you may remember John Willis as the publisher of the Theater World books. And Peter worked with John with the Theater World Awards very closely. And Peter, do you have some things you want to say about John?
Well, it's very sad to think that only 18 days ago, he was at the Theater World Awards. We knew he was very ill. There's no question about that. And he showed up in a wheelchair. Well, he was 93 years old, after all, and with oxygen tubes in his nose, and he wasn't even able to speak, I'm sorry to say. But at the party afterwards, when I went over to say hello, his eyes were sparkling. I mean, and that was nice. And he put out his hands, and he took one of mine and brought it to his lips and gave me a little kiss. And, I mean, that was really very nice. I'm sure he knew that he didn't have long to live at this point. But there's no question that there would be no Theater World Awards if it weren't for John Willis. He was one of the founders of the organization back in 1945, one of three. One fell by the wayside very early, and Daniel Blum, the other one, died in 1963. So since 1963, it's really been John Willis's event, and he's kept it alive mainly for all those years out of his own pocket. For decades, he was the one person who paid for everything, the hotel function room, the open bar, the hors d'oeuvres, the awards themselves. And let me tell you, these awards themselves cost hundreds of dollars, you know, so all on a school teacher's salary. That's what he was. He never tried to raise money, and I really got the impression he didn't, because he just didn't want to bother anyone. So he was really very special in that way, and he took it very seriously. I used to go up to his office on Riverside Drive, his home office, and see the charts that he made on who should win. And for years he did it himself. And then he felt that he wasn't going to enough theater because he was getting older, and he started a committee. And I was one of the people he asked to be on the committee. So that's how that happened. But believe me, when he said he wasn't seeing as many shows, that probably meant that he went from 300 plus to 200 plus. But still, he wanted to be fair to everybody. And as a result, he just didn't trust anymore that he was seeing everybody. So he got everybody else involved. And you might say, all right, well, once a year he put on this show. I mean, and he went to a lot of shows, which is fun for its own sake. Big deal. You know what else he did? And this is amazing to me. Imagine doing this. He made sure he sent a birthday card to every Theater World Award winner. Now, there are 12 every year, and it's been going on for 66 years. So, I mean, that's a lot of birthday cards. And one of the reasons that any time we have ever said to Alec Baldwin, anytime, Alec, will you come and present a Theater World Award? John Willis is the reason why, because he was stunned that one time he was on location somewhere in the middle of nowhere, like the Sudan or something, making a movie, and the birthday card arrived. It wasn't even like it was sent to his secretary and she forwarded it. On his birthday, April 3rd, in his hand was a card from John Willis, who knew that he was making this movie in the middle of nowhere and sent the birthday card there. So this is really something. I find it very interesting now that when we do the Theater World Awards, we have Mary Bodison, we have Aaron Ostreich, we have Katie Meister, we have me, we have Steve, we have Randy Hemming, we have a lot of people doing it what John Willis used to do alone. And I find that very interesting, that it takes all of us to do what he used to do. And I hope that we can keep the awards alive in his honor, because he always was and always will be, as I said a few weeks ago at the awards, always was and always will be Mr. Theater World.
That's a fitting tribute to John, who was really, I'd only met briefly some years back when I did a little bit of help for the Theater World Awards. But a great man, and
you never heard a bad word about him. You never did. You know, I mean, and I can't tell you how many people. Rosemary Harris immediately comes to mind. That when I run into Rosemary Harris at a party, her first words to me are, "Ah, how's John?" Immediately. You know, I'm sorry she won't be able to say that anymore. But that's how she associated me. And the first thing she wanted, and she wasn't being rude. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not taking this as an affront that she didn't say, "How are you?" I mean, but the first thing was, "How's John?" You know, because she was concerned for him, because really, I never heard a bad word about him. Everybody was just thrilled that he did all this and went the extra step every step of the way.
Absolutely. So with that note, I think we're going to wrap up our podcast this morning. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. On the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo, and there's a subscribe button right there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode, it'll be downloaded automatically to iTunes. That way, you won't miss anything. Also, if you want to reach out and say hello and touch us or give us some feedback, right above that button for subscribing, there's a feedback form on the front page in the upper right-hand corner of BroadwayStars.com. And you can send us an email, or you can actually give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 646-873-7695. And if we get a voicemail from you, we might also play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Matthew Murray and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.